I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for curious cooks and eaters. So you know how people say that necessity is the mother of invention? I kept thinking about that this week because we're taking a look at the inventive cuisine going on in Cuba right now, where cooks are constantly improvising from the black market. We have a look at an unsung cut of meat that someone just up and invented. And for all the times you stood in the middle of your kitchen, desperate for some stock for a recipe, America's Test Kitchen came up with a brilliant instant broth. But first, we have something that's, well, kind of the opposite of necessity. I'm guessing you absolutely know how to make a sandwich already, and you probably had one yesterday, but did you have the time to sit down and really think about all the different ways that sandwich you had yesterday could have been even better? Well, the good people at Bon Appetit magazine have done that thinking for, like, weeks. So when we were emailing with Adam Rappaport, their editor-in-chief, and he just casually mentioned, well, you know, of course you know that sandwiches always taste better when you cut them diagonally, I knew we had to talk with him because this was going to be some next-level geekery about bread and filling. So, Adam, it's great to have you here.
Psyched to be here.
So you and the magazine put together this enormous package on the A to Z's of the art of sandwich making.
Exactly. Not the A to Z of sandwiches. We're not running down every type, but like how to make sandwiches. Because I find that probably more so than any other dish, people are really particular about how they like their sandwiches. And even something like PB&J. I'm like, oh, PB&J, it's peanut butter and jelly. But then you ask someone, and you're like, oh, well, you know, obviously you use creamy. I'm like, what do you mean, obviously? No, you don't. You use chunky. And they're like, why would you use chunky? Creamy is how you're supposed to make a PB&J. And then you talk about, well, it's on white bread, of course. I'm like, I don't like white bread. I like multigrain. I want it sturdy. And then what, do you toast it? No, why would you toast it? And like, it gets into this whole sort of ethos and like sort of psychology of how to build the perfect sandwich.
And so from those conversations, which I would imagine are typically friendly, but the way you're characterizing them maybe are not such friendly conversations.
They can get a little heated at times.
Okay, so let's, I would love to hear some of the letters of your sandwich alphabet.
Well, all right. Well, let's get, for instance, P is for PB&J, and it's obviously it's for PB&J. Talking to some professional chefs, sandwich makers, and you're like, okay, well, how clever could they get, or they just make the same thing? And it was interesting talking to some of them, for instance, like this one sandwich maker, Pete Lemos, at Wax Paper in Los Angeles. He spreads the peanut butter and then crushes fresh peanuts on top of the peanut butter, which I like a lot, and then does a strawberry jam and then slices fresh strawberries on top of the jam.
Oh, my goodness.
So obviously, I'm like, oh, like that, yeah. Like, that works.
I love that idea.
Yeah. Tommy Habits at Bunk Sandwiches in Portland. This is kind of cool. He'll do peanut butter on both slices of the bread so the jam doesn't, like, leach into the sandwich, the bread itself. Because when you were a kid, you'd bring your sandwich to school. And half
of it's soggy.
Yeah, and you're like,
the jam is water-based.
Yeah, so then he'll do the jam in the middle and then sprinkle it with some sea salt.
Very smart. Like, yeah. There's a barrier philosophy.
Exactly.
I feel like when you put mayonnaise on a sandwich, almost always, I feel like it needs to go on both sides, both pieces of bread, for that same reason. Like, if there's, like, lettuce or tomato, the mayonnaise will act as that barrier. You want to protect the bread.
Well, yeah. With mayo, I'm one of those guys, I will literally just have a mayo sandwich. I love mayonnaise. Give me, like, a jar of Hellman's and a baguette, and I'm all good. And, of course, I know our listeners are in the South and be like, why aren't you using Duke's? And I'm like, because I can't find Duke's up here in New York. But it's interesting, yes, because mayo is fat. It also repels any sort of wateriness, you know, because oil and water don't mix. So if you have a wet tomato, that mayonnaise on either side sort of buffers it. And also, I think for flavor-wise, you always want to put something on both sides, you know, because you want that mouth feel to sort of connect on all different levels.
Yeah. Although I am also a firm believer, if you only put it on one side, the mayo has to go on the bottom piece of bread. Meaning the one that is going to hit your tongue. Because when you have mayo on the top, like if you're putting it on like a burger bun or something, it's on the top. I feel like you never taste the mayonnaise because you have to like fight through everything else before you get to the mayonnaise. And let's face it, the sandwich, well, to me anyway, is like at least 49% of the time, like a vehicle for mayonnaise.
I think a vehicle for mayonnaise and condiments in general. If you think about like, a veggie burger is not a sandwich, but a veggie burger even if you don't love veggie burgers, like you still get to put all the other good stuff on there, like a regular burger.
No shame.
But I think in our A to Z guide, A is for architecture. And that's the first thing you got to consider. You are building a sandwich. It's not a recipe. It's like, and where, what do you put where? And like, for instance, with cold cuts, like I love good ham, like prosciutto cotto, like cooked prosciutto or a Paris style ham. But I will always be like, if I'm going to the butcher to get some or the deli, whatever, like I want that shaved so thin it's almost transparent. Huh. And then you can sort of like create these little folds and like it's almost like a meat rosette. And that and that creates a sort of a loftiness to the sandwich. Like I don't want those, as a kid, you'd have those thick sliced cold cuts with that weird rubber sort of stuff on the outside. And it'd just be like this dense sort of mouth of like meatiness. Like I want airiness, and like that's that stuff matters. And then, well, where do you put the avocado so the avocado doesn't slide out? And like, you know, like these things are important.
Yeah, totally. I want to get to this idea of the thin sliced meat thing, because when I was a kid, my folks worked in New York City. They worked in Chinatown, and so Little Italy is right next door. And so they would go to like the delis in Little Italy, and no matter what they got, they would always come back super, super thin sliced. Like you said, like it's, they're almost like, like filament thin, right?
Yeah. First of all,
it's such a difference.
The Italians know what they're doing when it comes to cold cuts, all right? And like, and also what's interesting in Italy, the meats are always shaved super thin, because also like in, especially in the Japanese culture, like texture matters when it comes to food. And it's an important element in the taste experience. It's not just the flavor, it's the texture also. And also what I think, what I like about Italian sandwiches, like ones you get in Italy, they don't overstuff the sandwich with meat. If you get a, you know, a prosciutto or a mortadella sandwich, there's like an equal amount of meat to cheese to bread to some sort of butter or mayonnaise or whatever. It doesn't have to be this 6 inches of meat,
just,
you know,
like clubbing you over the head.
Yeah, which it's okay if it's pastrami, because that's kind of a different thing. But basic cold cuts, like I don't need that much mortadella in my sandwich.
And it's more about, you know, the combination than it is like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Every element in a sandwich, again, with architecture, should complement one another. Not one element should sort of dominate.
Yeah. I have to ask you about one of your letters.
Oh, okay.
D.
Yes.
For diagonal.
Oh, yeah. Well, obviously. Again. What? Every sandwich tastes better when it's sliced on the diagonal. So you get those triangular shapes, and that one pointy end is like the entryway for that first bite. You're like, okay, obviously I know to start there. And it just looks so much more modern. It's like a Mies van der Rohe skyscraper or something. It's like clean angles, and you're like, ooh, that looks good. Sliced in the middle, it's like I'm in second grade and just eating that peanut butter and jelly sandwich where the jelly's leaching through the bread.
I'm going to look forward to having this conversation with you again like 4 years from now, when like plating trends are all rectangles, and you'd be like, no, obviously you have to slice the sandwich down the middle so you have two perfect rectangles.
Oh, God. I'm a traditional modernist. Speaking of bread, another great tip in this package from Mason Hereford at Turkey and the Wolf in New Orleans. He, for all his sandwiches, and we named his restaurant Best New Restaurant in America this year, et cetera, et cetera. He griddles his bread. So he butters both sides of each sort of like nice white bread, fries those in a pan so they get nice golden brown. And then what he does, which I love, he either puts them on a cooling rack or builds a little teepee of them leaning against each other and lets the griddled toast rest for 30 seconds before he builds a sandwich. So the fat kind of collects back in, so it gets crisps up, so it's not like too warm and soggy as soon as the thing's going on. And you get this crisp, golden, crunchy bread toast sort of thing around any sort of sandwich. And it's like, that's one of those key moves. You're like, oh, that's genius. I'm doing that.
Yeah, totally. It's like, oh, if you have like beautiful French fries or fried chicken, like, you don't put the lid back on.
No.
You don't put the cover on it.
I've done that before. I've gone to get takeout fried chicken. I immediately get to my car and I open it up and I spread it all over the passenger seat.
Yeah. Just directly on the seat.
It's like, sorry, honey, but I had to.
I got to save the crispness. Okay, what are other letters that you love?
All right, so E for egg sandwich, which you see a lot of these days, egg sandwiches I feel like are having a moment after being sort of a basic thing in at least New York City for decades. And like what you see like at Wiley Dufresne's Dew's Donuts out here in Brooklyn, which he does, which is actually a classic French technique, is making the scrambled eggs super soft and custardy. And it's that technique where you make a scrambled egg over medium heat and you're constantly just moving your little rubber spatula around. So it almost takes on the consistency of soft polenta, these teeny little curds. It never develops any sort of skin or brownness. and it's done before you think it's done, and it should be, like I said, like soft pudding, and you just ladle that onto a sort of a, whatever sort of toast or cheese or whatever. And he also adds, which I love to do also sometimes, a dollop of cream cheese into the scrambled eggs.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That just gives it this magical creaminess and sustains that creaminess so the eggs never seize up. And you have that, and if you want to throw some like American cheese on there, you can also do that. But it's that texture, crispy griddled bread, custardy soft scrambled eggs. And again, it's just like, it's still just eggs and toast, but you're like, oh, that's a whole different level of eggs and toast that I've never experienced.
That's awesome. Okay, let's get out of here. I got to get a sandwich.
Exactly.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Francis.
Adam Rappaport is editor-in-chief of Bon Appetit, and you can find their guide for sandwich making in their March 2018 issue. Oh, and head to splendidtable.org. They have a recipe for us. It's for their Green Goddess tuna salad sandwich, and it's terrific. Okay, so Adam is actually, was probably not the biggest sandwich nerd I know. I mean, I know tons of sandwich nerds. I kind of run in sandwich nerd circles, and I think the biggest sandwich nerd I know is my friend Tyler Cord. Now, Tyler is one of the funniest and truly nicest human beings in the world, and I edited a book he wrote called A Super Upsetting Cookbook About Sandwiches. It's a blast of a read, and he's actually cracked the code of how to put together a great sandwich every time. So here's his philosophy. Are you ready? It goes, sandwiches are governed by the basic rule of delicious food. They should have contrast and harmony. And that means that every component of a sandwich should make the others more awesome by making up for what the other stuff lacks. So for a truly awesome sandwich, put these things between bread. Something salty and substantial, something fatty, something acidic, something sweet, and something crunchy. And that's it. Like, if you have all those things, you're flying. So, you know, let's take a classic example, like a cheeseburger. So the burger is salty and substantial, right? The cheese is fatty. The ketchup is both acidic and sweet. And, well, you eat it with fries for crunch, right? So substantial, fatty, acidic, sweet, and crunchy. And you can just Mad Libs it from there. Like Tyler's roasted broccoli, mayo, ricotta salata, pickled light cheese, and pine nuts. It's amazing. Or here's a classic. Roast pork and ham, Swiss, pickles and mustard on crispy grilled sweet bread. That, by the way, is called a medianoche, and it's beloved in Cuba. And coming up, we'll hear about Cuba and the in-home restaurants called paladares.
The word comes from a Brazilian telenovela, which Cubans were watching like crazy in the 1990s when the Soviet Union abandoned them. And it led to just a total economic collapse. And during the time where they were literally having sugared water for dinner, they're watching this sexy Brazilian telenovela about a girl who starts selling sandwiches at Copacabana Beach, and it's a Cinderella kind of rags to riches.
We'll be back. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Imagine you're a chef. How will you run your kitchen if you have no idea what ingredients you're getting that day? Now, not because you're waiting for your favorite local farmer to come surprise you with that day's harvest, but because you have to get your ingredients on the black market. Because you're cooking in a place where the government can make things like onions or even salt just go missing in a hurry. That's a question that was on Anya von Bremzen's mind when she started writing a book about Cuba. Now, she's not from there, but she's not really a stranger to the place because Anya grew up in the Soviet Union and went to a school where she was taught Spanish and poems honoring Fidel Castro. It was part of the two countries' like international communist romance. And of course, she grew up with those infamous Soviet breadlines and food shortages, so she understands firsthand the special kind of inventiveness that those shortages can inspire in a cook. She's written a book about the paladares, the private restaurants of Cuba that are actually in people's homes where the conditions are precarious, but where the cooking is full of optimism and creativity. She sat down with our contributor, the New York Times columnist, Melissa Clark.
Anya, welcome.
So good to be here.
So, Anya, what is a paladar? And did I say that right?
Paladar.
Paladar. And what made you want to write a book on Cuban restaurants and Cuban cuisine?
Well, paladar is kind of a speakeasy, plurals paladares. And actually, there's a really interesting backstory there. Essentially, there are private restaurants in Cuba, in a country where everything essentially is state-run. So that's already really interesting. And the word comes from a Brazilian telenovela, which Cubans were watching like crazy in the 1990s. And that was during the periodo especial, there's another Spanish word for you, the special period, when the Soviet Union abandoned them and it led to just a total economic collapse. And during the time where they were literally having sugared water for dinner, they're watching this sexy Brazilian telenovela about a girl who starts selling sandwiches at Copacabana Beach and makes it really, you know, it's a Cinderella kind of rags to riches, becomes hugely popular. And all the Cubans remember just salivating over this girl and her success. And here was an island where there was no food and no private enterprise. And then Castro, because the situation was just so grim, allowed some measure of private enterprise. And that also extended to private restaurants. So the first paladares, and they call them paladares after the Brazilian telenovela, which is very cute. And those first enterprises were, according to law, they were to be run out of people's homes. So they were already like speakeasies, no more than 12 seats, and two family members had to be employed.
Wow.
And basically there was no food, so everyone improvised whatever they could get.
Now, you are Russian. You're living in New York. Now, what is the connection with you in Cuba other than the Soviet connection? Is there something else?
You know, it was actually one of these cosmic kind of kismet, you know, luck situations. I really, really wanted to go to Cuba, hearing that was changing, and I kind of wanted to catch the last socialist moment to see how that society was. Because, you know, growing up in Russia, I was, my second language was Spanish. I went to Spanish speaking school. My mother just sent me there, and my first crush was on a Cuban boy. Raul Castro came to our school. It was like this model Soviet school for Spanish speakers. And you know, every other week, Fidel would come and, you know, kiss Brezhnev, which was like, you know, this bushy-eyed Brezhnev, you know, bushy-bearded Fidel. You know, they're all locked in this like internal socialist embrace, and you know, he would come for another handout from the USSR.
So what was that like to be there and to see the shortages again and to really, you know, be immersed in this culture that was similar to how you grew up? Or was it?
It kind of made me believe in time machines. It was an utterly, utterly surreal experience. Well, the first shock, literally, I screamed. It was so shocking. It was landing. We landed in a small town because it was they just inaugurated direct flights in Santa Clara. And I see all those American cars gliding by from the 50s. And I literally shrieked because it was like, you know, landing in Jurassic Park.
Right.
You know, you've seen one car in the museum, another car, but actually, you know, because they're so huge.
Yeah.
And they have sculpted things on them. So, and then I realized that the default car is not the, you know, the American Chevy from the 1956, it's the Soviet Lada. And suddenly I'm feeling like I'm back in the socialist moment of like 1989 when Russia was going through perestroika. Mm. So it was already open to the West. There was something trickling in from the West. There was this double economy where you could actually operate with dollars. So it was Soviet Union back in a very specific moment. And what was really incredible was not just that there was so much Soviet aid economically to Cuba, but that the whole material culture was exported from the USSR. And they still use it. The Soviet refrigerators that I grew up with, the Soviet cars, the Soviet washing machines. Imagine me sitting down, you know, this exotic island, sitting down with a bunch of, you know, Cubans my age, and we're all suddenly nostalgic for exactly the same foodstuffs. They say, oh, remember, you know, the Bulgarian stuffed peppers? All the socialists, oh, remember, you know, the Hungarian, you know, pickles with, like, you know, a picture of the globe on the cover? Oh, remember the Soviet condensed milk? It was just really the bizarrest thing and kind of very rewarding because suddenly, you know, you see that you are kind of socialist brothers.
The shortages are obviously a big issue. How do the restaurants run when they don't know if they're going to be able to get salt or butter or onions? How do you run a restaurant like that?
That is a million-dollar question. And what I've decided to do with this book, I've sat down with owners of, I think, 14 or 15 paladares. And I thought, like, not to get in their way, I will just let them tell the story. So the stories in the book are told in first person, in their voice, as told to me. And the biggest question is, yeah, how do you run a restaurant when there's a word perdido, going to be lost? So suddenly, you know, butter is perdido, salt is perdido. One restaurant told me, well, you know what my biggest salvation is? The chalkboard. And for me, the chalkboard is not a trendy, you know, bistro accessory. It's actually something, you know, when the service starts and I realize that, you know, two of the dishes I can't put in because something, you know, has gone missing, I just substitute it. The other woman, the Spanish woman who has a paladar, she said, well, you know, all this fashionable Spanish chefs from Spain and America come to my restaurant and they say, oh, and they talk about, you know, cocina de mercado, you know, market cuisine. She said, they don't realize we have nothing but the market cuisine. And market is completely quixotic. So it's supposedly a mango season, but, you know, the mangoes are not there. So you scramble, you know, to go to a hard currency store and get canned peaches instead of the mango puree that you wanted to put in and you substitute it. I mean, people, the other difficulty is there is no wholesale market and there's no legal export. So basically there's a suitcase trade. Mm. So everyone, if you need something like, you know, malt and salt, vanilla, spices, everyone brings it, you know, in their suitcases and they're not supposed to. So they wouldn't even talk to me on the record about it. And then people improvise. It's literally like you don't know what's going to be on the menu. And then all these people suddenly come knocking on your door with great fish.
Right.
So, for instance, there's one guy, you know, he runs these two places that are super hipster. They could be in Brooklyn. one that's called O'Reilly 304, another El Del Frente. And he's never been abroad other than Cancun, which kind of blew his mind. But the menu looks completely trendy and up to date. I says, how do you know things? He said, well, my secret is I have a connection at the Havana airport, and he smuggles Spanish food magazines to me. Or, for instance, somebody starts serving tataki, flash-seared tuna or beef. You know, it's a Japanese preparation. So suddenly, everyone is serving tataki. How do they know what tataki is? And they go, oh, well, there was some Japanese guy that came in, and he showed us what a tataki was. So literally, you know, people, there's a lot of USB drives with cookbooks. That's how information travels. Believe it or not, avant-garde Spanish chefs like Ferran Adrià is a total guru. So everything has become, you know, mythologized and surrounded by legends. And this you actually see in front of your eyes, a cuisine is evolving. But of course, they serve classics as well, black beans, rice, that kind of stuff. But since paladares are expensive, really expensive for locals, they serve, you know, that kind of stuff to foreigners. But locals, you know, they want beef, they want lobster, they want stuff that, you know, you can't get, that is forbidden, actually.
Now, who goes to these paladares? Is it only tourists or are there locals who can afford it?
There are a lot of expats, and a lot of the paladares are owned by expats, and their story is always the same. I kind of fell in love with Cuba. I fell in love with a girl or a guy. I stayed, and then I opened the paladar because there was no good places to eat. But there are enough, you know, there are enough Cubans who travel. You know, they bring business associates, a lot of people from Miami, a lot of their relatives that come. There's some really older, you know, popular ones. Even the state-owned ones, like, you know, there's this famous roast chicken restaurant. So there's this huge reunited families, you know, relatives from Florida come and they take out their Cuban families there. But there, some of them are completely full. You can't get in. You actually need a reservation.
And you can make a reservation just calling them up?
Yeah, if you can get online. if you're lucky enough to get internet, you can do that even.
Anya, thank you so much.
It's been a gas. Thank you so much.
Anya van Bremzen is the author of Paladares, Recipes from the Private Restaurants, Home Kitchens, and Streets of Cuba. Melissa Clark is the author of Dinner in an Instant, and Anya has a recipe on our website, splendidtable.org, inspired by Cuba's Chinese criollo cuisine. It's trout with black bean sauce. It's really, really simple and really, really delicious. I have a secret. You know, I do not always make my own stock, and I have excuses, but you probably don't want to hear them, and really, it's just laziness. But I improvise a lot. I save the cooking liquid from beans, or I will I will season water with fish sauce and some onions and use that, or Sometimes, every once in a while, I will crack open a jar of bouillon mix. I am not 100% sure what's in the stuff, but, you know, sometimes you find yourself with needs. But I do love a good stock, especially a good vegetable stock, because it's so versatile. And so I was psyched when I found out that America's Test Kitchen came up with a vegetable broth concentrate that you make from real food and just mix with water whenever you need it. ATK's Elle Simone explained how to make it to our friend, Joe Yonan, the food and dining editor of The Washington Post.
So I love making homemade vegetable broth, partly because the store-bought stuff is truly awful. I have not found any that I like. So pretty much every couple of weeks, I make it from trimmings of things that I'm cooking, but I still have to pour it into ice cube trays, and I put it into Ziploc bags, and it takes up all the space in the freezer. And you guys have figured out a much better way, which is to make a concentrate. So tell me about that.
Yes. And first, I will have to agree with you. Store-bought broths are horrible. I just wouldn't recommend it. But we have actually created a concentrate, which in your case would be helpful because it takes up less space.
Right.
You don't have to freeze it in ice trays. The concentrate is actually just made of some very key vegetable ingredients and some salt to keep it from actually freezing. And you can scoop it out and use it one tablespoon at a time.
Amazing. So how do you make it?
We have some leeks we use and dried onion flakes, because dried onion flakes have less liquid, you know, and we want this concentrate to be more flavorful from vegetables, not from water.
Oh, that's
We use celery
smart.
Root, which is also a little stronger than celery. It has more staying power.
Mm-hmm.
We have parsley, and we use the stems, tomato paste, and soy sauce for umami, and a whopping 2 tablespoons of salt.
So I love salt, but that sounds like a lot.
I mean, it does. 2 tablespoons of kosher salt does sound like a lot of salt, but it is a 2-to-1 ratio to like table salt. So it's really not that much. But we need those 2 tablespoons because it aids in the grinding of the vegetables. That's what, you know, keeps our texture nice and smooth.
Huh. Of course. And it's also diluted. So there's that.
Yep. And also the salt keeps the mixture from freezing in your freezer. It makes it easier to scoop out when you need it. No thawing necessary.
Yeah, when I saw this video of you making it, I did think that was an amazing moment. It's magic. It scoops out like a vegetable sorbet. So that's just because of the salt, all the salt in there?
Yes. And because we're also choosing to use vegetables that don't have like high water content, that also helps to keep the texture very even.
I see. So that's why you have the onion flakes instead of the fresh onion, et cetera.
Yes.
So when you're ready to use it, you just rehydrate it in water?
Yeah, you would do 1 tablespoon to 1 cup of boiling water. And you can use it like that if you like. You know, a lot of people actually use vegetable broth for cooking meat, using it for braising. It makes perfect sense. However, if you want to use it for your risotto or your gravy and you want something nice and smooth, you could strain out the particles, and you'd have a nice, delicious, clear vegetable broth.
Great. So how long can I keep it in the freezer, Elle?
6 months, honey. A long time. A long time. Actually, I think it's just the best fix, because instead of taking up all your cabinet space with all of these boxes or cans or whatever, you can just store this in your freezer and you have all the broth you need.
I love it. Elle, this is fantastic. Thank you so much for coming and sharing it with us.
Thank you for having me.
Elle Simone is a test cook at America's Test Kitchen. Joe Yonan is the editor of America the Great Cookbook. And you can find that recipe for vegetable broth concentrate at splendidtable.org. Let's say you're having people over. You're not sweating the food, you're a great cook, or you have the number of that new amazing Thai takeout place, and everything you know is going to be delicious. And let's even say that your friends are bringing the drinks, so you don't have to worry about that. So what do you have to worry about? Because you have to worry about something, right? No, you do not. You don't have to worry about anything. Because our friends Rico Galliano and Brendan Francis Newnham are here, and they are masters of the dinner party. Hello, gentlemen.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Francis.
So I love your book. I have to say, I take a little exception to the title.
Okay.
Brunch is hell because I'm the father of a daughter that needs to be in bed by like 7:30. So I don't get to go out at dinner anymore. So like, don't take my brunch away from me. That's all I got, man. Like,
no, that's okay. We give you a special dispensation. Actually, it's in a footnote in the first or one or two chapters of the book that new parents get brunch because it is one of the few times that they can go out.
All right, fine, Brendan Rico. We are here to talk not about brunch, but about dinner parties and how to throw them. In your mind, what matters when you're setting up your home for people to come over?
Well, it's a good question because we think part of the reason people aren't having dinner parties is because they do have anxiety about how their house looks or how their food's going to be. You know, if you have absolutely no time, the only thing you really, really need to do is just to clean your bathroom.
Yeah.
As basic as that sounds, it's the one room in the house where people are going to be alone. And you should probably check your medicine cabinet because your guests are going to. Other than that, then from there working out, you can then, you know, yes, clean up your living room, maybe put some old magazines away. The kitchen can remain a mess because that's often where people are going to be hanging out, but that's fine. That's where a lot of the work is getting done. And the reason we like dinner parties is because they are a reflection of you. So if your home isn't perfectly polished, that's okay. It actually can make people feel a little more relaxed about their homes.
How do you like to sort of get into the mode of like, I want to be present with people?
Yeah, that is absolutely one of the most important things about a dinner party is that it's one of the few places in modern life where you can just be present and share a conversation. You know, we have a list of challenges over time that the dinner party has overcome, and it's managed historically always to overcome these obstacles, but we're not entirely sure that it's managed to overcome the invention of the iPhone, which allows you to stream kitten videos at the dinner table. Some people have this idea that, like, everybody should give up their phones and, you know, put them in a bowl. That sounds vaguely kind of 1970s key party to us, and also like you're treating your friends like children. But I do think that you should police this a little bit. You know, if people are getting out their phones too much, just be like, hey, please. And there are places during a dinner party, there are kind of stopping points where it's perfectly okay to take out the phone, check on your babysitter, you know, see what the scores of the game are. Usually that's between, you know, dinner and dessert when everyone's clearing off the table, or you know, again, if you're going to the bathroom alone, and you can check your phone a little bit there too.
Okay, so we're at the table. We're doing our best to keep our hands off of our devices. Mm-hmm. And everyone wants to be like, you know, a gracious host and host the lively conversation where we touch upon the issues of the day with wit and candor. But sometimes it's awkward and I will like make an excuse to go back to the kitchen. So how do you get people talking?
Well, you know, there's a couple of phases to this. Before you got to the table, you welcomed people, maybe gave them a drink. You've introduced some folks, you've taken their jackets, and that is the time for small talk. And then by the time you've arrived at dinner, we've had some hors d'oeuvres, we maybe had some drinks, we've gotten to know each other. That's when, yes, we advocate for deeper conversation. The number one rule, we think, is shut up.
Weirdly.
Weirdly, it's to get out of the way. It's to listen. People want to be heard, and often in life, they're not. And so if someone's in the of a story, let them have some space. There's no rush.
It's fascinating. We actually have a quote in the book from what seems like an unlikely source, Alan Alda, who's actually done some research on conversations and the ways that information is transmitted. And it turns out that when people tell stories, their brains literally sync up. When someone is telling you a story, your brain syncs with that person.
Huh.
So a goal of a good dinner party is to get people to tell these stories because you're literally mind melding with the other people at the table.
Oh, I love that.
But in the moment, it's really like go with the flow, make it personal, and put characters, you know, talk about people as opposed to abstract principles. And often people will listen in a little bit if you're telling a story about how a person was affected by something, a policy, as opposed to just the abstract policy.
That's right.
Thanks so much, Brendan Rico.
All right. Goodbye, Francis. Look for our invitation in your email.
Anytime, Francis.
Rico Galliano and Brendan Francis Noonan are the authors of Brunch is Hell, How to Save the World by Throwing a Dinner Party. Coming up, Doc Willoughby with an unsung cut of pork you'll want to look for. But first, I'll get to talk with you. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM American Public Media. It's Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. and it's time for us to talk. You and me. You can always call us 1-800-537-5252, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter, or email us, contact@splendidtable.org. We always want to know what you're working on in the kitchen, what you're trying to figure out, or if, you know, you just want to chat. And we have Betsy from Long Island on the line. Hey, Betsy, what can we talk about today?
So for the past few Olympics, my friends and I have had an Olympic party where we all take a country and we make dishes based on whatever country we've chosen to represent. I'm hosting the party, so I've decided to take South Korea as my country. And I was just curious if you had any ideas for dishes that I could make in order to represent the country well for my party.
Yeah. Okay, so how many people you have coming over?
So it's going to probably be between 20 to 30, but everybody's making a dish. So it doesn't have to be like a potluck.
Oh, cool. Okay, so, I mean, I love Korean food, and so that is a great choice. I mean, I'd be really, you know, hats off to your friend that's going to pick, like, Azerbaijan.
right, exactly.
It's going to be a little hard to find a cookbook for that, but Korean food, you have so many options for cookbooks and great recipes online. For dishes, I think a couple things. Since you're hosting, you probably don't want to be stuck too much in the kitchen cooking right when people get there. So you probably want something that's sort of make ahead.
Yeah.
And I'll give you two ideas. Tell me what you think of these. One is a dish called galbijjim. So galbi, a lot of times if you go to like a Korean restaurant, a Korean barbecue restaurant, if you get galbi, usually that's like a marinated, short rib that they'll like, you know, grill or barbecue. And... Mm-hmm. But galbi just means short rib. I believe it just refers to the cut. It's not necessarily that preparation. And jjim, I believe, means stew. So galbijjim is a stew. It's not spicy. In fact, it's pretty sweet. It's short ribs braised in soy sauce, often like some pureed pear, mirin, which is sort of like a sweet rice wine, and like often you'll have like potatoes and carrots. So when you look at it, it'll look like almost like a pot roast type of stew, but then you taste it and you'll taste garlic and sweetness and soy sauce and all these different flavors that will just be delicious. And you have a nice big pot of rice next to it. And that's a really nice thing because it's a braise. You can obviously make it ahead or just keep it warm in the oven for a while. So that's a nice thing to do.
That sounds great. Yeah.
I'm also thinking, if you have a lot of people over and people are going to have dishes and, you know, there's going to be a lot of like mingling and, you know, I want to try this, I want to try that. You can make something fun and like really interactive. And this is like sort of the most, maybe the most sort of stereotypical Korean dish, a bibimbap. But I think it's such a fun thing to do for a crowd because what you can do. So bibimbap is, if you've never had it, it's often a bowl of rice. And on top of the rice, there'll be lots of different toppings, usually just warm or room temperature. Lots of different vegetables. You can have like a spinach, you know, just a blanched spinach seasoned with a little bit of salt and sesame oil. That's a really nice simple one. Maybe some sesame seeds on top of that. You can have some shredded carrot that you've maybe sauteed. You can have shredded zucchini, similar. You could also quickly saute it. So you have a nice just array of different vegetables, maybe some sliced shiitake mushrooms that you've just kind of cooked a little bit and some soy sauce and sugar, you know, just little things that, like you can make a bunch of them, just a small pot of each and then lay them all out with a big thing of rice and let people kind of make their own, you know, make their own rice bowl with, I like spinach a little more than I like carrot or I like, you know, and often they'll be topped with a fried egg. So you can have some fried eggs for people. Or maybe a little of like marinated, sauteed beef or pork. So you just let people just kind of like top it. And then you make a beautiful sauce with this stuff called gochujang, which is a Korean chili and like fermented soybean paste. It's usually a little sweet, savory, spicy, and funky. It's like got every flavor known to man all kind of like mixed into one. So you can either make the gochujang or just you can buy it oftentimes in certainly in Asian markets and even in grocery stores, they'll have it. And let people kind of do it up however they want. So you can kind of lay it all out. And again, the rice should be warm, but all the other dishes can just be kind of warm or room temp. So again, you can make it ahead, lay it out, and people can just have fun with it.
Oh, okay, great. That's both are such great suggestions. But with the beef and bop, I had saw something online and I just didn't know how to maybe do it for a large crowd. But that's a great idea to do it in an interactive way. Could be
Don't mess around with making different bowls for people. Just kind of set it all out
there. Right, yeah, because I thought I'm not going to have time to make everybody their own rice bowl, but they can do it themselves.
Yeah, totally. It's a party.
Yeah, the best dishes do win medals. So if I win a medal, I'll have to give you all of the credit.
No. I'm just the trainer. You know, like you're the athlete. You got to go and do it.
There you go. Anyway. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Well, have fun.
Oh, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks for the call. And we have Tim on the line from Seminole, Florida. Hey, Tim, how are you?
Hi there. I'm great.
Fabulous. What do you want to talk about today?
I want to talk about cream of tartar. So I have been cooking since I was like 8 years old. I love to cook. My whole family cooks. Everybody always gets involved with it, and the kids, and you know, especially my grandmother. And so I have been cooking on my own since 8, and I'm 31 now, and I have never had a recipe call for cream of tartar. But if I'm cooking one of my grandmother's recipes or her grandmother's recipes or we have like her great-grandmother's aunt's recipes, they call for it a lot. So I don't know what it is. I don't know where it comes from, and I don't know why we use it.
Okay. I'm with you in that I have never actually used cream of tartar as like an ingredient on its own before.
Right. I have the same container of cream of tartar that's been sitting in my cabinet for 15 years.
Okay. So as far as I understand, here's the deal with cream of tartar. First of all, it's like a really gross name because all I can think of is like bad dental hygiene when I hear it. But, and it has nothing to do with cream or tartar on your teeth. So where it comes from is, I think traditionally it was made from wine barrels. And when you have the wine fermenting in the barrels over time and aging, you know, the liquid starts to evaporate, right? So the actual liquid is reducing in the barrels, and there's a crust around the top of, you know, where the liquid used to be. And I think cream of tartar is when they used to scrape that crust off. And so it was cream because it rose to the top. And the tartar actually refers to tartaric acid, which is the kind of acid in the wine.
Oh.
So really what it is a powdered acid. And, you know, I think people used to use it, not necessarily to make things sour, but where you would use it is to, like, spark a reaction with, like, a baking soda.
Well, we use it in biscuits.
Exactly. So I think that's the traditional use. Now, like you, I've never used it myself, because if I'm using acid, I would use a vinegar or a lemon or a lime, something like that. But there's one fantastic use for cream of tartar, and I do keep some at home for this reason. And it's a recipe from Edna Lewis and also her protege, Scott Peacock, and they swear by homemade baking powder. And you make homemade baking powder by doing 2 parts cream of tartar to 1 part baking soda. Sift it together, and then I'll keep for a few weeks. Then you use that the same way you would use, you know, regular baking powder you'd buy. But I hate the flavor of baking powder, because to me it has this like metallic, really tinny flavor.
Yes.
You know, when you get a biscuit that has or pancakes that have too much of it.
I know exactly what you're referring to.
So yeah, that gross flavor. This gives you all the lifting power of baking powder, but without that flavor. So
fantastic.
It's great. So that's why I keep cream of tartar at home and I haven't figured out another use yet, but that is way good enough for me.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much. I mean, you not only explained where it comes from, you explained the science. So that's really cool. I really appreciate it. And I'm looking forward to
hearing
you on
the show.
You should
Google it and like fact check me. I may have made it all up. I don't think I did, but I may have. Cool. Well, thanks so much for the call, Tim.
Well, absolutely. Thank you for taking it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
And remember, you can call us anytime and leave a voicemail. You can leave questions, thoughts, ideas, whatever you want to talk about. 1-800-537-5252. So you know what's way more fascinating than its name implies? Butchery. I mean, if you say someone butchered something, You're saying they, you know, they kind of hacked it up and they made a mess of it. But real butchery isn't hacking stuff up. It's a highly skilled craft. And you might even call it an art. Because every steak cut or chop was really an invention. You know, animals don't come with instructions, so someone actually had to decide and figure out how to take a whole tenderloin out, for instance, and slice it, give it the name filet mignon, and then convince you that it's worth more than other cuts. So butchery really is all about creativity with some salesmanship thrown in. And that brings us to a juicy little cut of pork called the country style rib. It's a cut my friend Doc Willoughby has been obsessed with. So hey, Doc, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, you are super into country-style pork ribs.
I am. I think they are an underappreciated cut that is perfect for this time of year when we're making stews and braises. And in addition, it is usually the cheapest cut of pork in the supermarket meat counter. So it's got a lot going for it, and people don't know it.
Okay, so I have to admit I'm a little confused. Because every time I've seen country-style pork ribs, there doesn't seem to be a rib involved. And I'm like, that's how you do it in the country? Like, there are no ribs in our ribs? Like, that's what we do out here?
Well, this is a cut of pork with a little bit of an identity crisis because it isn't really a rib. It's just called a rib. And the reason for that is it's basically a made-up cut.
Huh.
So what it really is a blade chop, which is a chop from that comes from the area between the loin and the shoulder.
Okay.
But the blade chop was always very difficult to sell because it's a little bit fatty and gnarly compared to loin chops.
Mm-hmm.
So butchers had a lot of trouble selling it, so they generally ground it up for sausage, or if they were a little sneaky, they'd put it under a bunch of loin chops in a wrapped package of chops, right?
And so the loin chops are like the classic,
they're from the
beautiful
center, they're
pork chop.
Fine-grained like and you know, not much fat and you know, very pretty and even. And you know, country style or the blade chops, a little fatty, a little gnarly, not so regular. So yeah, they were hard to sell. So back in the 60s or 70s, someone is not sure quite when, a butcher in Chicago thought, well, ribs are popular. What if I take these blade chops and butterfly them, lay them open, cut through the rib, and call them ribs? So if you do that and then you turn them on the bone side, you've got a nice fat, looks like a giant rib, which it actually isn't. But it's very attractive when you put it that way. And he started selling them, and they became super popular. So country-style ribs were born. And now you can get them all over the country. It's a little confusing because there are a couple other things people also call country-style ribs. And just to make it simple, they tend to cut a little further down into the shoulder.
Okay.
So there's a little more fat and a little more gnarl. But whichever one of these you have, they have enough fat and gnarl so that they're perfect for braising and stewing, and they have light and dark meat on them. So you get different textures and different flavors, and they're super easy to cut up. You know, if you're going to make a pork stew, you shouldn't buy what's labeled pork stew meat because it's just like little bits and pieces from all over the animal that they had left over. So what you usually do is buy a pork butt and then you butcher that, but that's a pain. So if you buy all the country-style ribs, they're these sort of small, elongated pieces of meat, and you just cut them into little cubes, and you're done. You're ready to go. So they're ideal for that. They're great for braising because they, you know, they brown easily, they fit into a pot very easily, and they love long, slow cooking. So, and as I said, they're the cheapest pork you can buy.
Yeah, I love that.
You have to pay a little attention to what you're getting. I was looking for them in a supermarket, and I finally found them, but they were labeled blade end ribs for barbecue, country. So I'm not sure where that nomenclature came from, but they were good. Butchery is complicated, and it's different in different countries, and it's different in different parts of the country, and the same cut has different names in different parts of the country.
Right.
So you have to kind of educate yourself and know what you're looking for. And then there are the cuts that are invented, like country-style ribs, or the tri-tip, which, you know, the tri-tip is a muscle on the sirloin that was always just cut as part of the sirloin until back in the 50s, a butcher in Oakland, California started cutting it out as a roast.
Yeah.
And so it became well-known as a roast in California, but not until recently on the East Coast. So, you know, it's an evolving art.
Yeah.
The more you know about how people are butchering things and why they're naming different things, the better shopper you are, so then the better food you have.
Right on. Well, thanks so much for this little lesson in meat cutting.
And Meat Marketing.
Yeah, thank you, friends.
John Doc Willoughby is a writer and editor, and he wrote an article on country-style ribs for the New York Times called The Kindest Cut of All. You can find his recipe for country-style pork ribs with Chinese flavors at splendidtable.org. And that's the show for this week. Thank you, as always, for listening, and I am going to go out and make myself a sandwich. Oh, hey, if you make a great one this week, let us see it. Tag us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. You can find information on all the things you heard here today at splendidtable.org. There are tons of recipes on our site, and you can register for a monthly giveaway. And we want to go where you're going. Take us along, subscribe to our podcast, and if you really like us, please leave us a review. Our production team includes senior producer Jennifer Russell. Jenny Lubke is our editor and technical director. Erica Romero is our assistant producer. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. And thank you for tuning in. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM, American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.